flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Looking for a new home should be exciting, not frustrating. That's why Homes.com might just be the best home shopping site out there. Imagine searching for your dream home without ads cluttering your view. Homes.com's sleek, beautifully designed, ad-free interface makes your search simple and distraction-free. And if you're a parent, you know how important school information is. Homes.com gets it. They're the only site with detailed school and district info from multiple sources, including reviews from Niche. Plus, they've got a super comprehensive and transparent agent directory, making it easy to find the right expert to guide your journey. Oh, and here's a game changer. Homes.com always connects you directly with a listing agent who knows the home best. They even go beyond the basics, offering the most in-depth neighborhood content of any home shopping site, packed with details to help you find a community that feels like home. And the search tools? Unmatched. With 22 data visualization layers, 7 environmental layers, and filters for commute times and architectural styles, Homes.com truly is the home search you've been searching for. Go to Homes.com. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
That's right, folks. We are live from Radio Row in the host committee's center, and we celebrate this big game week. You can feel the momentum just increasing moment by moment, and we
it's
are
dramatic.
Brought to you by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso, and we appreciate them sponsoring this event for us today, and New Orleans and Company, and so many folks on the host committee. It's been great working with them in the build-up towards this event.
Three journalists came through here, videographers or web broadcasters, in the last hour, and they were doing these live broadcasts or these live web feeds right in front of us, and it's just amazing to see just, oh, and there's everyone taking pictures, and you see people typing away, and there's right there you can see a live TV show going on, another one over there, and then the live radio show over there, and just the sheer number of people that are keep coming through here, and they keep bringing more and more shrimp out, too, so that's a good thing. The more shrimp, the better.
Louisiana shrimp.
Amen.
As far as that's concerned. You know, we are joined by Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins me every month at 12 o'clock, and we're so very happy that he's able to do so yet again today. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you. Sorry I can't be with you down at the NFL experience.
Well, Guy, you know, you have your finger on the pulse of a lot of what's going on in the community. Your thoughts real quickly about Super Bowl week here.
Super Bowl is really one of the most phenomenal marketing events ever. Unlike the Olympics, cities that get a Super Bowl actually make money. And it's the sort of thing that you really want to get, because you draw in a real crowd of great visitors. And, of course, we welcome all visitors, but a normal visitor in New Orleans for a weekend might spend about $1,200. A Super Bowl visitor is going to spend about $2,600. So you start out with a demographic of people that are coming with the expectation of spending a lot more money. And then we absolutely fill up things like the airport that you don't think about.
No, absolutely.
Voisant, Armstrong is going to be filled in the Atlantic and Signature parking areas. Lakefront Airport is going to be filled. And what happens is
the private
they're
jets
able
all
to
over
charge landing fees.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think one of the fun things to do is to go out to Messina's and watch the planes land, because you're going to have everybody there, including Taylor Swift, landing at New Orleans Lakefront. notwithstanding the landing fees from $17,000 down to about $2,600, depending on the type of airplane.
Guy, do you realize what you just did? You just sent Tay-Tay fans scrambling to find a way to get out to Lakefront Airport and to find out when Taylor Swift's going to be landing there, and their parents and everybody they know is going to have to go with them. Oh, goodness.
That could be a best kept secret. I don't know, but it's going to be interesting to see whether or not it truly is. One thing that's not a secret is these tariffs that President Trump has announced over the weekend. I think it took a lot of people by surprise. Your thoughts, Guy?
Yeah, I really hated to see the tariffs for a couple of reasons. One, you know, you never want to have a fight with your next door neighbor. You know, I think anybody who's lived in a city like New Orleans where we're close to our neighbors, you want to have good friends on your left and right side. So I would not have picked on Canada and Mexico. I really believe it is a negotiating tactic, and we've already seen the Mexico tariff suspended for 30 days. Now, the problem is Canada is going to be a little bit of a different matter. The Canadians are mad at us right now, and understandably so. You know, Canadians booed the national anthem when it was played at an NBA game, and the Canadians are running commercials by Canadian. They canceled the contract with Starlink to provide satellite communications for Ontario. And if the Canadians decide to take a hard line, it'll certainly hurt their economy, but it'll hurt ours as well. And I just hate to alienate somebody that's that close to us and we've had such good relations with all these years.
Guy, just so people understand, what is it that we trade with Canada that would be so impactful?
Several things. One is oil. Our refineries are all designed to process different types of crude oil. And we bring in a significant amount of crude oil from Canada, and it actually a fair amount of it comes all the way down here to Louisiana. It's a particularly heavy crude, and we have refineries that are designed to handle it. You can't easily switch from one grade to another. It's a very expensive process. So it actually would increase energy prices. The other big areas are wood. The Canadians grow an awful lot of the wood that's used in construction, and we got two giant rebuilding projects coming soon. We've got the California rebuilding after the fires, and then the rebuilding on the East Coast after the hurricanes. So missing those wood supplies from Canada is a big deal. And then oddly enough, when you go to McDonald's and get the fries, a lot of the frozen French fries come from Canada.
Really? Not from Idaho?
You'd expect Idaho, but They ship us a lot of French fries and a lot of cherry tomatoes, another thing you wouldn't expect. Mexico sends us a lot of tomatoes, but the Canadians grow hydroponic tomatoes and send us cherry tomatoes.
Guy, there was some news. I saw an alert earlier that said that President Trump had put a pause on the tariffs with Mexico. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, very good news. There's a 30-day pause, and the compromise is Mexico is going to send some troops to the border to work on suspending and denying the narco-terrorist the access to send fentanyl across the border, and also undocumented immigrants. So there is a compromise. The U.S. has also agreed that we're going to work harder to prevent weapons being shipped into Mexico illegally. And a lot of people think that what Trump is doing is basically leading with his fist and saying, look, we want to reach a point of better negotiation, but we're going to start with this. And, you know, perhaps it'll work, but it's really a blunt instrument. And as I say, we have a 30-day suspension with Mexico. The Canadians seem to be taking a bit of a harder line.
These tariffs sure seem to be a very impressive negotiating tactic that the Trump administration has found, not only with the Mexicans to get the results you just mentioned, but look what happened with Colombia when they initially refused the plane loads of illegal immigrants from the U.S. being returned to Colombia. The administration threatens tariffs and suddenly, oh, no, no, bring them. but Canada's plan, maybe not so influenced, but this has been a strong negotiating tactic that could have huge economic implications for both us and these other countries.
Yeah, and in the long run, if you get into a fight where both sides are take a stand that they consider principled and refuse to negotiate, you can end up with both sides hurting each other. And that's my fear, particularly with the Canadians. If we don't reach a deal quickly, that, you know, we'll get to the point that each side feels that they have to maintain their position. The other thing that's a little ironic is China violates free trade agreements far more than either Mexico or Canada, and we only increased the tariffs on China by 10%. It seemed like it should have been the reverse if we had to do it, you know, 25% on China and 10 on Mexico and Canada.
Yeah, it's. I think that it was going to put a 10% tariff in addition to the tariffs that are already in place on China immediately, right?
Yeah, and it's important to remember, even President Biden didn't take the initial Trump tariffs on China off. He left those in place. There's some tariffs on appliances, some tariffs on steel and aluminum, and then tariffs on electric vehicles.
Now, the president articulated a position that some of this is directly as a result of immigration policy. To me, that makes sense as it relates to Mexico. It doesn't make nearly as much sense as it relates to Canada, although there have been some incidents on the Canadian border, but not many. As it relates to Mexico, is this part of their, you know, strategy that's kind of revealing itself as to how to deal with the cartels along the border?
I think it could be, and I think that's part of the agreement with Mexico of using troops to fight the cartels, because the cartels are the ones that are charging immigrants substantial fees to get them across the border. So a lot of money is being made by illegal groups in Mexico escorting people across the U.S. border, and the U.S. is saying, look, y'all really need to weed that out, and that does seem reasonable. I wish we'd used a different method to get to that point.
Historically, though, the Mexican military hasn't been very successful because of the influence that the cartel has in and amongst the ranks in Mexico. Is there a belief that this could change that the Mexican government really can use its military to overcome the issues it's had historically in fighting the cartels?
There's some optimism. There are a couple of reasons for optimism. You have a new president of Mexico, first lady president, and she seems determined to weed out the corruption. One of the real challenges is the cartels have a lot more money to spread around than the government does. So they can pay their enforcers more than the Mexican government pays soldiers. So it is a real challenge. And Mexico has a legitimate point that the cartels make money shipping drugs to us. And if we did a better job of interdicting the drugs, they wouldn't have the cartel influence that they do in Mexico.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. If nothing else, they can serve as a disruptive force, though, right?
I think they will. I'm optimistic that this will be a positive direction, and I'm hoping the 30-day pause turns into a permanent deal, because we do rely on Mexico for an awful lot. They make appliances, they make automobiles, they send us an awful lot of fruits and vegetables. You know, Super Bowls right here, you got the guacamole, essentially all comes from Mexico.
So, Guy, if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, there's a lot of, you know, competing information about who pays for the tariffs. How does this play out?
The answer is not simple, and it depends on the commodity being tariffed. So if there's not a substitute, if it's something we really need. And an example is China has a lot of the exotic minerals that we need to make batteries. And a lot of the exotic minerals we need to make rockets, missiles, and defense products. So in cases like that, China will say, look, we have these rare earth minerals, and we want to receive a net $100 after all expenses. And if you want to raise a tariff, that's fine. We're going to bump the price 10%, and instead of selling it at $100, we're going to charge you $110 so that we net the same price. So if there are products like that that you don't have substitutes, then the buyer ends up paying the tariff, whether it's a U.S. company or the U.S. government. And, of course, then the buyer ends up having to either reduce their profits or pass it on to the consumer. And most companies don't have the a 10% profit margin, so they end up passing the tariff onto the consumer. So if it's something that can't be replaced, like some of the battery packs from China, the rare earth minerals, we end up paying the price, either directly as companies or indirectly as increased prices to consumers. If it's something that can be easily replaced, and the example would be the Chinese clothing, you know, the Shein and Temu that ship incredibly inexpensive clothes to the U.S. We can get clothes from Indonesia, from Vietnam, from other places. So in that case, the Chinese vendors are more likely to absorb that themselves. So in that case, we're not going to end up paying that price. So it depends on how needed the commodity is and what alternatives you have. If you don't have alternatives, then the buyer ends up paying the price, and it ultimately could actually end up being a bit inflationary as well.
So it's a little bit of all of the above, and if you do not want to have that economic impact placed upon the backs of the citizens of this country, it really requires a laser-focused tariff strategy, right?
Yeah, which is one reason I don't like across the board. I mean, you need to have a little more focus, a little more intention, and particularly in the case of China, I would focus on things like you need to actually obey the trade agreements you've signed. You need to quit stealing intellectual property and quit evading the sanctions on Russia. If you have objectives like that, then you have something that you know you're negotiating for. It's hard to tell what we're negotiating for with a country like Canada. I'm not sure what we want them to do that they're not already doing.
And there's risk involved any way you slice it, because while we would all love to buy everything made in America, and while we would all love to spend our money with American-based companies, we would all also not be able to afford our current lifestyles if that became completely true and real, because Americans in some sectors cannot compete with Chinese and Mexican-made goods, right?
Yeah, and the classic economic theory is that countries are good at certain things, and if you let a country that's highly efficient and very good at what they do sell that commodity, everyone benefits. The country that makes it benefits, the country that buys it benefits, because they get lower prices. So traditionally, both Democrats and Republicans have believed that free trade made the U.S. better and richer. And I do believe that's true. You have to have some rules in trade, but we're better off. The other thing is there's some things that we just don't make here in the U.S. or don't grow here. You know, if you like coffee in the morning, we essentially make almost or grow almost no coffee. We have a little bit of Hawaiian coffee grown, but that's about it. So you start tariffing everything from other countries, you're going to raise your coffee price. Same thing with tea. We grow a tiny amount of tea in the U.S., but essentially all of it's imported. So it's good to let countries that are better at things do it and have us benefit from the efficiency that those countries have.
All right, we're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We will be right back from Media Row here in the host committee's booth. And it's a buzzing. And
yeah, you can feel it. Super Bowl week, baby.
You can feel it building. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with
us. Ah, can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising? People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience? Visit stateofaudio.com to see Audacy's State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative. Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
With us. We are here in the host committee's booth here at Media Row, and you've heard us describe this over and over again. I keep looking around, and it never ceases to amaze me what direction you move in, you know, or look at.
I have never seen so many headsets in one place in my life. I just walked out there during the commercial break, and I counted at least 100 people wearing headsets. Because there are so many
it's both,
podcasts, radio shows, television shows, and everything else going on. And so it really is unbelievable. And we did confirm that number. 6,000 journalists
here.
And we use the term journalist maybe a little loosely, but 6,000 individuals who are in one way, shape, or form covering the Super Bowl in New Orleans are here now. And the stories that they are going to tell are hopefully amazing, wonderful, enticing, and alluring to their consumers, because this is really just, you cannot buy this kind of exposure unless you have a Super Bowl.
The more wins we can have, the better off we are. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, I was curious if you happened to see the Washington Post article, and I think there was something on it in the Wall Street Journal as well, about USAID. The organization that I think is part of the State Department, $40 billion in appropriations, providing money to about 130 different countries. 10,000 people work for this organization, and two-thirds of them serve overseas. It looks as though they're on in the sights of DOGE. Did you happen to see that article?
Yeah, sure did. The agency is the U.S. Agency for International Development. And what Elon Musk wants to do is fold that directly into the State Department and remove its separate agency status. And I think one of the things that people in D.C. should be aware of is Elon has a propensity for operating businesses with far fewer people than you would think are required. When he took over TikTok, he cut the workforce by 90%.
No,
but yet
Google,
continued
no,
to operate.
I mean,
no, the
Twitter,
business.
Twitter, not TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah. He hadn't taken over TikTok yet.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the do you know something we don't know? Was that Freud?
Yeah, it could be. They talked about selling it to Elon Musk. That's on hold right now. But Twitter, thank you for the correction. But he proved you can operate with far fewer people. And you do wonder, do you really need 10,000 people to give away money? And his other fear and his thought is, it seems to be that we're supporting an awful lot of leftist governments that are not really on our side. And while aid in an emergency is important, the thought is, you know, we're just going to close it. And, I mean, he literally closed the doors this morning. If you're an USAID worker, you can't get in the building and you don't have access to the computer system. So I don't know where that ends up, but his feeling and his statement was, this isn't an apple with a worm in it. It's all worms and no apple. So his thought was eliminate this agency and just fold the grant giving into the State Department.
Well, I thought it was a brilliant idea. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, diplomatic relations, and obviously you're giving away all of this money, you know, it would seem to me that you'd want to streamline that process so that the State Department, who's actually in charge of foreign relations, can leverage the fact that they're giving away all of these dollars and have a more of a direct line of authority over how that's going to be spent.
Yeah, I think there's some real logic to that, and certainly I think you can do it with far fewer people. So there is room for some streamlining, and I think certainly for some efficiency, and some of the groups that have received the money are really violently anti-U.S., and you do wonder, why would you want to help them? And there are people who just,
unless there's some political
interest. Our aid.
We're capable of creating enough enemies on our own, right? We don't need to pay them to be our enemy, right? I mean,
it's like, oh, exactly. Or reward them for bad behavior, which sometimes happens.
You know, you hear these stories and you're just completely mystified by how did we get to this juncture?
And we've all heard the idea of a $500 hammer and a $200 plunger and all the inefficiencies in spending and all the redundancies in agencies and groups and all that. And Guy, I think to most people, you think, yes, government is highly inefficient, so there's got to be lots of great ways to make it more efficient. And is this one, though, that really accomplishes that goal?
I think it might, and I think a corollary is the FEMA example. You know, FEMA doesn't actually do the work. What happens is FEMA appropriates money, and about 30%, maybe 40%, never leaves Washington because FEMA then allocates it, then it's subcontracted to one of the groups that operate in Washington, referred to affectionately as the Beltway Bandits. And then they find another subcontractor, they find a third subcontractor, and finally somebody hires someone to put a blue tarp on a roof. And when you dig down into the cost, you say, wait a minute, we paid as much to put a blue tarp on the roof through all these FEMA subcontractors as it would have cost to put a new roof on the house, a real new roof. And I remember this because when then-Governor Blanco was talking about FEMA, I was a member of the board of the American Bankers, and I was meeting with FEMA often. And I just said, is there anything I can help with, Governor? And she said, ask them for 50 cents. And I said, what do you mean? I don't understand. I said, they've allocated a large number to us in Louisiana. Cut the number in half and just write the check to me, in me being the state of Louisiana government, and we will spend it, and we won't ask for any more money. Just let us do it ourselves.
Half would
be
enough.
Keep it in Washington. And of course, I made the proposal. FEMA turned it down because I don't even know why. I said, why would you turn this down? You save money, the state's happy, life is good. But the inefficiency
You're threatening their relevancy, though.
Yeah, Guy, I'm disappointed in you. You're trying to interject
logic
and common sense to the equation. It's not going to work.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of logic to, you know, if there is a disaster, and there will always be disasters, send the money to the governor who knows the state best and say, okay, here's the money, spend it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't need 30,000 people at FEMA to write checks to other people in Washington.
Absolutely. Let's finish on a positive note. New education numbers have come out relative to our kids. Your thoughts?
I'll tell you what, this is one of the best stories that has been underreported. Louisiana is one of the few states that actually saw significant improvement in education. And we're actually being cited by things like the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, Louisiana should be an example to the rest of the nation. So here's what happened. We all know that COVID shutdowns were a disaster for education. But when you look at fourth grade math from 2019, we were literally number 50, as bad as it gets. We couldn't even look over our shoulder at Mississippi. We move up to 44 in 22 and to 38 in 24. So moved up 12 places. Fourth grade reading, same thing. Dead last, moved up to 42 in 22. But here's the really good news. In 2024, 16. That's number 16 out of all the 50 states. Eighth grade math, from 49 to 45 and then up to 43 this year. Eighth grade reading, 45 to 39 and now up to 29. So big, big improvement. There are only two states that went up, and we were one of them. And that, I can't recall the last time we were at the top of one of these good rankings. So hats off to Cade Brumley and the state education administration for what they're doing and the changes that they've made and the improvements that's occurring in Louisiana. This is going to be a big long-term benefit for us.
You're right. It has been totally underreported on so many different fronts.
And we've had Kate on a few times, and we've kind of tracked some progress. But it looks like the baby steps may be turning into larger steps or leaps at this point in some cases. And that we should shine a spotlight on that. Absolutely.
Well, Guy, thank you so much for joining us today. We truly appreciate it, as we are broadcasting live from Media Row here at one of the host committee booths. We thank you, as always, for your time and your insight.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We've got a special treat from one of our sister stations, 106.7 Fan. Grant Paulson joins us from the D.C. area, and he had the pleasure of covering Jaden Daniels. I am jealous. I mean, what a year.
It was an unbelievable season in D.C., and it was a great ride, and I got to say, you know, he was so impressive. Everybody saw him on the field and the unbelievable exploits. But we were just taken aback by the work ethic and the decency. You know, for such a young guy who is the face of the company now. He is in charge of that Fortune 500 company in terms of the visual face for everybody. He did such a nice job as a rookie and handled himself so well.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise us here because we got to know him for 2 years at LSU and really was always a stand-up guy, defined the team in everything he did. And, you know, watching him and what he did for Washington, I think gives everyone hope in every NFL market, including here in New Orleans, that if you get the right people in the right places, you can turn things around in a hurry.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? I always say there's four pillars that hold up the building that is an NFL team. So it's the owner, the GM, the head coach, and the quarterback. Maybe not exactly in that order. Washington this past season had a brand new ownership group for the first time in 25 years, who hired a terrific young general manager, first-timer in Adam Peters, who brought in Dan Quinn, who of course has coached in the Super Bowl in Atlanta. But then the key piece was Jaden Daniels. Now you can have the other three locked in. If you don't have a quarterback, you got no chance. And for Daniels to have had a historical rookie year, the likes of which nobody ever has before, really changed everything. They went from a team that has not had a 11-win season since 1991.
Wow.
That has not won a playoff game since I was in high school in 2005. I mean, this was their
best year. That's the Katrina year for locals reference. Right.
Categorically, their best year in 33 years. And Jaden Daniels is the biggest piece of that pie.
How has he been received in D.C.?
It's a love affair. I mean, people are obsessed. His jersey is flying off the shelves. Frankly, the success that they had this year and the success that he had this year probably will lead to them keeping their current name. You know, forever they were the Washington Redskins.
Right.
Then they became the football team and then the Commanders. And it's not a popular name. People don't like it.
Yeah.
Well, their owner today just spoke and said that Commanders now mean something, that Commanders in the building is resonating, that there's now this kind of identity and culture they've created with this name. Well, that's just a year ago, everyone hated the name, and now there's very positive memories, right? You go out and you win 14 games, including two playoff games, which is more than they've won over the last 30 years combined. It's all because of this renaissance led by Daniels. And really, I believe it started in the offseason. Veteran players would get to the facility at 5 in the morning, and he'd already be there working. Now, he just, by the way he operated, changed their entire organization.
It's a very similar path that we experienced here with Drew Brees.
Yes.
He had that same work ethic. Not so much what he said, but what he did, right?
I think it's more than anything else, you watch him if you're in that locker room and you go, he just wants to be one of the guys. He's very unassuming. Yes. You guys know this from his LSU days, but he is not a spotlight guy, which is unfortunate for him because he's a superstar.
Yeah.
But he blends in very well. The team, to their credit, he hasn't done a lot of one-on-one interviews or he's not on TV much. He lived all season with his mother. It was those two. Maybe the father, I don't know. But she had a place there and kind of watched over him. It was football and being at home with his mom. And you just didn't see him out and about. He was in before everyone else in the morning and there all night. He just put in all of the work, checked every box. And then the game started. And he played at a level no rookie ever has before.
Yeah, I got to imagine Thursday night at the NFL Honors here in New Orleans.
If he doesn't get Rookie of the Year.
We're going to see Jaden Daniels up on that stage a few times.
Yes, you will.
I can promise you, if he doesn't get Rookie of the Year.
And he will unequivocally be the Rookie of the Year. I will say what's surprising, honestly, and this is a conversation for another time, but that he probably should have gotten more attention in the MVP conversation.
I think so.
I think the reason he didn't is we are conditioned, if you're a rookie, that you just don't blend the two. You win the Rookie of the Year award, but you probably don't get to be in the MVP convo. But look at the supporting cast. If we're talking value, which is the argument for Josh Allen to win over Lamar Jackson for a lot of people, oh, but it's only a couple Pro Bowlers, it's only a couple All-Pros. You have Terry McLaurin, who's a great wide receiver, but nothing else in terms of Pro Bowl talent on that offense for Washington. So Jaden Daniels, in a lot of way, I like to say, drag them into the fight over and over again, and then drag them out a winner.
Well, if they had won one more game, if you hadn't had that heartbreaking loss in the NFC Championship, then you would have no choice but to have him in the MVP conversation and be leading out of the gate. And they would have had to said, yes, you can be Rookie of the Year and MVP. I guess.
You know what's tough is he played really well in the NFC title game.
Yeah, he did.
They lost, but it wasn't because of anything he did. They gave up 55 points. They fumbled three times. He did throw an interception, but it was when the game was out of reach and he's trying to make something happen. And that was kind of the beauty of his season, is he almost never turned the ball over. But all the way to the end of the year, he gave him a fighting chance. Even against the best the NFC had to offer, he goes to Detroit and lights up the Lions. Then he's got the two seed. You know, they beat the three seed, the one seed, and then we're at Philly giving the two seed a run for their money for a couple of quarters.
And you're right. If other players don't allow the ball to be punched out, if other players don't make unfortunate mistakes, then this is a totally different conversation.
We're visiting with Grant Paulson, 106.7 Fan, our sister station in D.C. Timing's everything. This whole stadium talk right now, I got to imagine the quality of the product that they had on the field this year with Jaden Daniels and staff really helps perpetuate in moving that forward, right?
Oh, categorically, yeah. They're absolutely going to be building a new stadium. Their eyes are on 2030. They're still at this point trying to figure out where it's going to be. There's three municipalities that all want the team, Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. They currently play in Maryland. It's very likely that they end up in D.C., which is where everybody wants them to be. D.C. forever did not own the land where the old RFK Stadium was. It's a whole thing about federal land. Everything in D.C. takes years, not days. You guys won't be
surprised. We were talking about government efficiency just a moment ago.
Yeah, I was listening.
This all plays in.
That resonated. So it took quite literally years and a Hail Mary, proverbially, for D.C. to get the land back, which they now do have. Yeah. So still a lot of fighting now at the D.C. City Council level,
right,
which you guys can relate to. But the long story short of it is they're hoping to be playing in D.C. They're going to build a stadium. It's going to be about 2030.
Absolutely.
Grant, thank you so much, man.
Yeah, we really appreciate you joining us today.
We wish you were here with the Washington Commanders, who are now commanding in the Super Bowl. At least I wish that, because we wanted to see Jaden Daniels make
Jaden
it all the
Daniels
way.
So.
You and a lot of people back in the DMV. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Grant Paulson, 106.7 Fan, our sister station in the District of Columbia. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Noel, that was fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Scoot's going to have fun next.
What do you think about this place?
It's really nice. I love that we're right next to a place where they're sampling shrimp.
Yeah, well, that's from the host committee. The host committee is handing out shrimp to make everybody, all the 6,000 journalists here, happy.
Well, at some point, we're going to see everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Scoot's up next. We'll be back tomorrow, Newell.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it.